Hello, I'm Rihanna Elise Anderson. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Public Health in the Health Behavior and Health Education Department. And if there's one thing you got to know about me, I'm a Detroiter. So as a Detroiter, I thought about the world around me. I looked up and down my street, which was full of memorials of folks who have passed away. So these beautiful bears, these beautiful flowers would be tied around a tree. And sometimes I would hear the gunshots myself, and I would wonder, what is it that people are doing within these communities? Why are they responding in this way? Why is it that we have these experiences? And also, what are people doing in the aftermath? How are they responding to seeing these memorials, these reminders of what it is that's going on in urban life? So as I grew older and I started noticing more things and also talking to more people, getting more knowledge on what is happening in our communities, I saw this inextricable link between racism, poverty, practices and policies that were impacting folks within Detroit and other urban communities. So a trauma writ large is once someone is experiencing a stressor, so something in the environment that requires a great deal of resource to contend with this very large demand. That might be a general stressor that we're thinking about. When it becomes traumatic is when that stressor is so large and looming that we think about it quite a bit. So it takes up quite a bit of our mental space. It may take up some of our physical space. So the way that our heart or our bodies react to what's going on in the world, that might be a physical reminder of that thing. And whether we try to have this consciously or not, so we could be sleeping. It could be an unconscious reaction when we hear a song. There are so many elements about trauma that are unsolicited, that happen when we don't want them to, that trauma is a bit deeper in the fabric of our mind and our body than a stressor, which we typically can utilize resources to manage. What becomes racially traumatic for a lot of people are specific racial instances that, again, have this memory, have this vicarious kind of reaction that people are seeing and they're feeling whether it happened to them or not. So that vicarious nature, if we're seeing Tamir Rice, if we're seeing Trayvon, and you see Black boys asking, will I be next? That is a racially traumatic incident that, because of the nature of those boys seeing themselves in these other young boys, that they're asking that question, could it happen to me? What makes racial trauma really unique, again, is not only that it's a racial incident, but that it can happen to people who are like you. It could happen in the past, so a generational trauma that you somehow still know about, you somehow still feel it, has somehow changed your makeup in response to that. So in the same way that trauma occurs across the lifespan, and in fact, we have certain categories for children 6 and under and those 6 and older, racial trauma is quite readily available at any age. So we know that children as early as 9 months old can see racial differences. So that noticing, that acknowledging happens very early on. But what youth can tell you, I've worked with 5-year-olds before who have said, oh, like Tamir, oh, like Trayvon. So some of the racial traumas that we know are gonna impact folks a little bit earlier, because race is something that requires a bit more cognitive capacity to get. So at about 10 or so, you're starting to understand, oh, not only because I'm this race is this happening, but people around me that are this race, that's happening to them too. Oftentimes, parents who were once children themselves, you all hopefully remember that time for you, had instances in school where you were faced with a teacher that doubted your ability, a counselor who said you couldn't go to that next level. Something that may have seemed innocuous at that point, but perhaps if you look back upon it, your ability to live your best life was encumbered by someone at school when you were young. So now you have a child, and maybe that child goes to the same school, and you're wondering, do I go to that PTA meeting to see that teacher who said something like that to me? Do I go back to that counselor to try to advocate for my child? And even if those people aren't there, that memory, we call it a memory, that memory is still there. So when we think about how parents own backgrounds, how something that even happened to them can impact them now, that's one way that we're thinking about it. Another way, of course, is that direct relationship of what's happening to your child in this moment. So if a teacher, if a counselor, if someone from administration is impacting your child negatively, your child may not want to go to school. There may be some resistance there, and there may be friction even between you and your child as a result of that. If your child maybe isn't voicing what's going on, you may be very frustrated with your child. On the other hand, if your child is saying, this is what's going on, it's related to race, you might be wanting to act on behalf of that child to go up to the school, and that might, again, be causing some tension there. So it manifests in so many different ways, but we also have to just be mindful. It may not be current stuff. It could be the things that happened to us in the past that are coming back, and the ways that it comes up now could be, if it's recognized or if it's not recognized, how that impacts our relationship with our child and our relationship with folks at the school. Racial trauma really stifles our children's ability to learn. I'll use an example that I talk about quite often. If a racial incident happens over a weekend, and there perhaps are conversations in the house, or maybe there aren't, right? But there's something that happens over the weekend, and your child goes to school. What's the first thing that happens at school? Does the teacher actually stop and address it? Is there circle time? Is there an opportunity in folks' journals to debrief if they're older? What is it looking like to give children not only the space to process, but you as a teacher, you as an administrator, the folks within that school, if they're thinking about what can I do to aid in this child's process? If that doesn't happen, the child is learning this is not important to folks who care about me, which means that my life is not as valuable. The folks who look like me aren't as valuable. And that's going to interrupt their ability to learn for that day, maybe that week, maybe that month. There are so many things that rest upon their identity, like what it is that people see about me. What time did we get to actually unpack that? So again, you can imagine that Monday, if it is not unpacked, whether at home or in the school, that child is not only getting those messages, but they're thinking about it. So it's taking up that cognitive space. Is it gonna be me? So the teacher's teaching a lesson about math and you're up here thinking about how many more years do I have to live, right? That's not the calculus that we should be thinking about as a child, but that's exactly what they have going on in their mind. It's taking up that space. It's taking their breath, their physical breath that they should be using in gym, right? It's taking it to make sure that they're breathing because they've heard that people can't breathe. These are all processes that are happening on that Monday and the following days. And if we as school leaders, as folks who engage with schools, don't ensure that trauma is being unpacked and attended to, we're gonna have a class, an entire class, an entire grouping of children who are going to be so challenged dealing with these racial traumas either on their own or at home, but don't get that support at home, or excuse me, at the school, that academic task, the thing that they're there for, isn't going to be able to be attended to. But it really requires everyone to come together to have some dialogue, some really uncomfortable, challenging dialogue, and some next steps to get the world to where we need it to be. So if you find yourself holding an identity that you call yourself an advocate, you think about yourself as someone who doesn't hold the identity of an oppressed group, then understand you may have privilege to do something about this incident or something that happened in the community or some feeling that folks have over what has happened in their or other communities. Are you taking time out in a parent-teacher association meeting? Are you sending a newsletter that acknowledges that you're seeing what's happening? Oftentimes, what's unwritten, what's unsaid, is absorbed as being unimportant. So are you saying, we're gonna create space, we're gonna have time for this dialogue? Are you doing a balanced job of listening and providing information? So no, you shouldn't put the total burden on other people to share their story, but there shouldn't be such a mic grab that other folks can't say what it is that they're feeling. So are you doing that balanced job of listening and also giving a bit of your thought or opinion there? Finally, resources are quite important. Are we meeting the dollars in our schools with the needs of our students? Are we doing that emotional check-in? Are we hiring counselors? Are we meeting the needs of our students is an important question. And as an ally, as an advocate, and as someone with privilege and or resources, that might be an important space to be as well.